The fire in Waco. Perhaps not since the Reichstag fire in Nazi Germany have flames leaped so visibly into the pages of history. The flames in both Waco and the Reichstag fires may have been fueled by mind control. At least that's the impression you get when you read Attorney Paul D. Wilcher's letter to Attorney General Janet Reno. Dated May 21, 1993, the letter begins with no salutation. The phone numbers of Mrs. Reno, Justice Department Communications Director Carl Stern, Appointment Secretary Melissa Mueller, Assistant Attorney General Richard Scruggs, and James Kramarczyk, Special Ops, CIA. With the typical lawyerly lack of style, the letter begins. R.E. Vital new information concerning the conflagration at David Koresh's Branch Davidian compound, the Ranch of Apocalypse, outside Waco, Texas, on Monday, April 19, 1993, which is now being kept from you and covered up, i.e., that's what happened was not a mass suicide, but rather mass murder. The meaning and significance of this new information, particularly with respect to the Justice Department's ongoing Waco investigation and future indictments and prosecutions, you are headed totally in the wrong direction, because Bush administration holdovers in the Justice Department, along with others tied to CIA, are preventing you from even learning the truth about what actually happened in Waco. The extreme sensitivity of this information and my specific proposal as to how you should handle it, the lives of key participants, other witnesses, and even myself are now in grave danger as a result of my passing this information on to you. If you let this information fall into the hands of the wrong persons, some or all of those who know the truth about Waco and are now prepared to come forward and testify could well be silenced, i.e. murdered, in the very near future. And the extreme importance of this information to the overall quality and justice under the Clinton administration, to your own place in history as Attorney General, and to President Clinton's very life and personal safety. This information, if handled in the manner I have spelled out in detail below, presents you and President Clinton with a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to expose, confront, and hopefully root out much of the system-wide corruption which has been at the core of the federal government for at least the past 30 years. Then the letter reads, Dear Attorney Reno, the purpose of this letter is for me to deliver you extremely sensitive information about the deaths of 86 men, women, and children who perished at the Branch Davidian compound on Monday, April 19, 1993, and the truth about how it all happened. But even more important, my purpose here is to demonstrate how the Waco tragedy fits into a much bigger and far uglier picture, and to present my specific detailed plan as to how you should attack the overall problem at its root cause. The plan I'm offering here is not at all what you might expect at first glance, for it is far more comprehensive and deals with far deeper root causes than you have thus been made aware of. Indeed, although you may not realize it, you are still surrounded on the Justice Department, the FBI, the BATF, and elsewhere throughout the government by Reagan-Bush holdovers, many of whom are determined that you will never learn about the core issues and ugly truths which I have laid out for you here in some detail. Full of hope, and apparently not knowing Janet Reno, Wilcher expressed his optimism that Mrs. Reno would use her good office to, quote, attack the system-wide corruption which has been at the core of federal government for at least the past 30 years, and to bring about the most fundamental and far-reaching changes in terms of historic basic honesty and integrity which have occurred in our national government for at least the past generations. Wilcher then launched into a long section entitled, What is the Right Thing to Do? The prose is filled with citations of law and excerpts from Reno's own rhetoric. Especially noteworthy is where Wilcher quotes Reno saying, quote, Sometimes doing the right thing is very politically unpopular. Sometimes it will be painful for all. If necessary, hurt someone. But with strength and courage, let us face that question unafraid and together seek justice for all. The subject of mind control is introduced on page 4 when Wiltshire writes, David Koresh had an extensive CIA background. He was known in CIA circles as a sleeper. Someone who had been subjected to extensive CIA mind control training and programming. Wiltshire said that it was not a coincidence that all these events were occurring in or near Waco, Texas, since Waco is a major center for such CIA mind control experimentation and programming, with much of this activity occurring at CIA's Leadership Management Institute in Waco. Wiltshire pointed out that similar CIA-sponsored cults are located across the country, including such places as Salt Lake City, Utah, Provo, Utah, Logan, Utah, Boise, Idaho, and San Francisco, California. And the ones or all of these other cults can likewise explode onto the front pages of the press at any time the CIA deems appropriate in order to accomplish its predetermined, hidden, right-wing political agenda. Wiltshire indicated to Reno that he knew who had committed the murders, who had ordered them, and who had been part of the chain of command. He then lapsed into more resuscitation of disciplinary rules and codes of professional responsibility from the American Bar Foundation, all of which had bearing an ethical consideration for Reno. In fact, he was outlining for Reno reasons why she must begin to weed her own garden in the Justice Department, as well as within the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Thoroughly covering the details of lies told by government employees at Waco, Wiltshire wrapped up the motivational part of his argument and launched into a background briefing on events leading on the February 28th BATF raid on the Davidian compound. Number one, to begin with, Vernon Wayne Howell, also known as David Koresh, had connections to CIA. Number two, indeed he and six of the men in his inner circle were among CIA covert operations as sleepers, persons whom the agency had performed mind control experiments on and who had been programmed to carry out specific pieces of CIA dirty business at some point in the future, once a specific cue or signal was given to them by their contact persons or handlers within the agency. Number three, third, David Koresh was very much like the Reverend Jim Jones, in that he too was a gangster who used a Bible instead of a gun. In a note, Wiltshire remarked, Jonestown was not a mass suicide any more than Waco was. Instead, Jonestown, like Waco, was a mass murder, in order to generate and guarantee that there would be no survivors to tell about the CIA's extensive mind control experiments which had been performed on mostly black victims of Guyana. The letter resumed. Number four. Fourth, David Koresh was also very much like Charlie Manson, in that he, Jones, and Manson all demanded and received total domination over and total submission from all of the men, women, and children in the group. Number five. And like the Reverend Jim Jones and Charlie Manson, David Koresh likewise had received much of his mind control training at the hands of CIA and was a product of their system. Number six. In other words, David Koresh may have been what most people would consider a thoroughly disgusting and mentally disturbed megalomaniac, but he was CIA's megalomaniac, or at least someone that they were all too happy to use for the devious right-wing purpose and when the opportunity presented itself. Number seven. Indeed, David Koresh and these six other men in his inner circle had apparently been pre-programmed by CIA to become on-cue Manchurian Candidate-type robot assassins. Here Wiltshire inserted another note, quote, this is one of the most crucially important pieces of information concerning this entire scenario. Koresh and his six fellow sleepers were apparently pre-programmed by CIA to become wind-up, use-once, then throw-away robot-type assassins, much like A. Sirhan Sirhan, the man used as CIA patsy to the assassination of Senator Robert Kennedy on June 5, 1968, B. David Hinckley, the man used as CIA patsy in the attempted assassination of President Ronald Reagan on March 31st, 1981. Number 8. The CIA had apparently been able to produce Manchurian Candidate-type robot assassins ever since the late 1940s, using methods reminiscent of the brainwashing we've all heard about in the Soviet Union and America, prisoner of war camps and prisons, as well as far more sophisticated and sinister techniques which have been developed and perfected over the intervening years. Number 9. One of the most important features of this kind of mind control programming, of brainwashing, is the fact that critical segments of the subject's memory, including most of all of the program and experience itself, are erased or at least suppressed and deeply buried, with new false memories implanted into the subject's unconscious mind in their place. Indeed, all of this mind, behavior, and memory alteration is done at a subconscious or unconscious level. Indeed, once CIA programming had been completed, memory blocks are installed into the subject's subconscious mind to make it next to impossible for him to ever recover those critical minds and behavior, altering experiences from his internal memory bank. Therefore, since he is unable to remember what he has done to him, or when, where, how, or under what circumstances it happened, he is also virtually helpless to confront and overcome what CIA programmers have done to him. He is thus at their mercy from then on through, of course, they have no mercy. Number 10. Then, at some time in the future, upon given a specific secret signal, known in advance only to his CIA handlers and his subconscious mind, in which to any untrained persons, such as husband, wife, co-worker, would be overlooked as being totally innocuous, he would automatically revert back to carrying out whatever behavior he has been pre-programmed with to perform on cue. Nearly always some violent or criminal act against a person or group CIA has targeted for destruction. At least, that's how much mind control programming is supposed to work. Number 11. It is also important to note that such mind control programming generally includes one or more pre-programmed self-destruct responses, so that the subject can be ordered by his handlers to commit suicide, again, as a kind of mindless, trance-like, robotic response, which he would not even be consciously aware he was ordering to do, or that he was actually carrying out, until it was too late to save him. If and when his handlers ever deem it necessary for him not to be available for questioning by persons who might be able to uncover the truth about the secret programming and or what tasks had been pre-programmed to perform his trance-like robotic state. These self-destruct responses would typically be triggered by the subject's handlers once he had successfully performed his pre-assigned mission, or once the mission had been called off or altered, or under any other scenario under which he would no longer be of any value to the agency, as well as protecting his handlers and the agency itself from any exposure, liability, or accountability under what is called plausible deniability. David Koresh's psychological profile, however, showed him not to be a person ever likely to commit suicide. Wilchner sent over cover to the programming of Candy Jones and the death of George Demolish. Most of it has been covered in his books before. He also is a devotee of pages of CIA use of DC police and U.S. Park Service officers to cover what Wilchner says were CIA covert operations in which six black men were murdered in Pershing Park, two blocks from the White House. These pages are all worth reading, but due to space considerations, I've deleted them. We pick up where the letter again begins. Number 10. Mind control and memory blocks to ease the conscience of the CIA's professional killers. Quote, thus far we have been discussing mind control and memory blocks in the context of the CIA's Manchurian Candidate-type robot assassins. Those low-level individuals like Sirhan Sirhan, Hinckley, Mark David Chapman, who assassinated Beatles lead singer, songwriter John Lennon, and the six black men murdered in Pershing Park persons, who are programmed by the agency to be used only once, then thrown away, and discarded, persons who are destined either to be killed or imprisoned for the rest of their lives once they have performed their preordained secret mission. In other words, those low-level individuals are highly expendable, particularly when getting rid of them will preserve the plausible deniability that the agency had anything to do with their training, conduct, or activities. In the context of these low-level individuals, the mind control programming we have been discussing is not only in to condition the desirable robotic response to a preordained secret signal, but also to prevent the subject from remembering anything to do with their training, conduct, or activities. In the context of these low-level individuals, the mind-controlling programming we have been discussing is not only to condition the desired robotic response to a preordained secret signal, but also to prevent the subject from remembering anything about the conditioning and programming experience so that he is virtually helpless to counteract or overcome it. Without many years of deep hypnosis and therapy, as in the case of Candy Jones. There is, however, a totally different category of covert operatives employed by CIA. The real professional killers are used for multiple high-level, top-secret missions over an entire lifetime. These top-level black operatives are generally men of extraordinary intelligence, education, talent, training, and experience. And it is into their hands that most of the real dirty work of the agency is completed by top-level assassins, is entrusted. For example, the agency will use a low-level programmed robot like Sirhan Sirhan or David Hinckley to be the patsy for the top-level assassination or assassination attempt like the murder and attempted murder of Senator Robert Kennedy and President Reagan, respectively. But they rarely entrust the task of actually pulling the trigger in such a high-profile case as a low-level cutout. Instead, the real work is such top-level assassination is carried out only by the agency's true professional killers, persons who are not used to justice and just once and then discarded, but who instead are used over and over again, year in and year out, for nearly all of the agency's most secret and sensitive dirty work. Wet ops, such as dirty work, is generally referred to among black operations within the agency as wet operations. Operations where one or more persons are to be killed, where human blood is to be spilled. Debriefings after CIA wet operations. The normal procedure is that after each black or wet operation, all persons participating or connected with the operation are totally debriefed by a special debriefing team sent from agency headquarters, including a psychiatrist skilled in the various mind control and memory block techniques we have been discussing. In this debriefing, each member of the WET team is required to recite to the debriefing team exactly what happened during the operation in a precise, step-by-step, detailed manner. Each member's recitation is generally repeated several times, once normally, once under hypnosis, and once with a polygraph, and once under scopolamine. And only when the debriefers are fully satisfied that they have gotten all the details and they're going no glaring inconsistencies between these two different recitations is the debriefing brought to a close. Part of the reason for this debriefing process is to provide detailed records and feedback to the agency concerning all of these top-level black and wet operations. Precisely what has been done? What was the operation's success? Did it go off as planned? What makes it, if any, were misstayed? And what improvements can be made so that on succeeding operations, the task at hand can be accomplished even more professionally and expediently? Wiltshire exerts another note stating that his point cannot be overstated. Quote, "This means that deep within the bowels of CIA, if you only know where to look, you can find the detailed debriefing records on all of the black and wet operations carried out by CIA over the past 30 years or so. You should subpoena these records immediately, Attorney General Reno, and once you get them, if you get to them, you should put them under the tightest security imaginable to protect them from being tampered with or destroyed. It's hard to believe that someone who could write a letter which contains the information, this one, would be so naive as to not understand how successful the cryptocracy has been under the National Security Act. Wiltner appeared ignorant of the extent of the cryptocracy's indoctrination. It has gotten virtually everyone in Congress and the judicial and the executive to support it so that it can hide behind the tacit agreement among politicians that the security of this nation does not lie within the people, but with a secret government. Summing up his comments on the wet debriefing process, Wiltner wrote, quote, "Then, at the conclusion of the debriefing, once the debriefers are confident they have gotten all of the factual details, each operative is put under deep hypnosis, and the psychiatrist in the deep implants memory blocks into a subconscious memory. First, to make it far more difficult for him to remember what he and his other wet team members did during the operation, to block many of the gory details as to precisely how each of the persons targeted for elimination was taken out, i.e. murdered, so that he will be less likely to be troubled by recurring nightmares concerning what he and his team members have just done. Second, to alleviate the guilt which otherwise would be associated with these memories, and to allow him to justify in his mind, to the extent he is able to remember what happened, that when he and his fellow team members did was praiseworthy rather than highly criminal, i.e., that the person or persons they murdered were a menace to society and deserved to die, and that he was doing the country a valuable service by eliminating these targets from society. Of course, these memories of what he and his fellows have done on these various wet operations are never completely erased, and can, with work, be fully recovered, barring physical damage to the brain. But at least these mental blocks make it easier for the operative to live out himself and his conscience, and help to keep these vivid and gory images from flooding into his consciousness and becoming obsessive thoughts and recurring nightmares. These memory blocks are also a way for the operative to justify his having acted in the target's accuser, prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner, all in one fell swoop, without the targets having been given the benefit or any due process whatsoever. No notice, no hearing, no right to confront and cross-examine his accusers, no right to put on a defense, no right to testify personally or call witnesses in his behalf, and no right to be tried before an honest judge and a jury of his peers, according to the laws of the Constitution of the United States. These memory blocks thus help the operative to suppress all these troubling thoughts which might otherwise disturb his waking hours or his restful sleep, thoughts which might otherwise force him to re-examine his calling as one of the CIA's top professional killers and to consider seriously whether he ought to pursue some other line of work. In discussing the pros and cons of wet operations, Wiltner revealed the extent to which he himself had bought into the myth of national security. He said that there may be more argument in favor of such wet operations to take out foreign agents, overlooking the glaring historical reality that whatever good civilization employed ruthless and immoral tactics of an evil enemy civilization to fight it, those tactics eventually come to be applied at home against the people, and the good nation becomes evil as the one it was fighting. Islam teaches that the greatest war is always the war one fights within. The result of sinking to the level of the enemy has always been, both in the sphere of geopolitics as well as in the singular life of an individual, self-defeat. Or as Pogo said, "I have seen the enemy, and the enemy is us." Wiltner did argue, however, that he could see no excuse for using wet operations to take out innocent American men, women, and children, such as the 85 who were killed at the Branch Davidian compound. Returning to the letter at point 17, Wiltner wrote, quote, "The point to be made here is that David Koresh and his six fellow sleepers were low-level Manchurian candidate-type programmed robot assassins who were scheduled to be used at some point in the future, but who had not been used for their preordained secret missions. Note, well, whereas the wet team that went in to take them out were some of CIA's top professional killers, the term sleeper in this context connotates 1A, that the mind control programming which has been done on Koresh and his inner circle had probably been done a number of years earlier. B, the secret instructions implanted deep into their subconscious memories had lain dormant over the intervening years. C, CIA now had roused Koresh and the six others from their deep sleep, i.e. to reactivate their secret conditional responses implanted in their subconscious memories in order to get them to perform their preordained secret missions on cue whenever CIA deemed it appropriate and necessary. CIA could also activate secret self-destruct signals discussed on page 20 to 22 above to cause the robotic suicides of Koresh and his inner circle once they had been performed their secret mission, or at any other time CIA decided that we were no longer to use to the agency. Wilchner then went on to discuss Koresh's enormous stockpile of weapons, saying that he believed the arms were accumulated with their apparent knowledge and consent of the CIA over a period of several years. Wilchner believed that Koresh had acquired the arsenal for a specific purpose, which was not just self-defense, but rather for the purpose of carrying out whatever secret assignments they had been given by CIA handlers. He said the reason Koresh was so skilled in controlling his followers was that he and the other five sleepers in his inner circle had been through such intensive and total mind control programming themselves. It is not clear whether he presumes they had been totally or partially deprogrammed along the way so they could remember their programming codes, cues, and triggers. Without them, and without full recall and extensive deprogramming, the fact that they had been through such a process would be of no use to their conscious minds. Wilchner said that the reason behind the original raid by the BATF on February 28th was, quote, not to surprise Koresh or take him peacefully. The purpose was to be a heavy-handed and as unsubtle as possible so that Koresh and his fellow sleepers could not possibly miss the message, either shape up and get back into line, or we take you out, we will kill you. In the letter to Reno, Wilchner said that he was messaged to the cryptocracy wanted to give was not for six sleepers within the compound, but to others who might be getting out of line. Be prepared to carry out the order we will give you, exactly as you've been programmed to do, or you and all your loved ones will have hell to pay for your disobedience. Wilchner makes note of the what others were also independently saying, that in the ensuing siege of the Branch Davidian compound, there were certain BATF agents who were targeted to be killed. Linda Thompson's video of the Waco siege shows four ATF agents being killed by a fifth agent after they crawled into a window from the roof. Wilchner told Reno that Waco was an important tool of PSYOP's campaign waged against the American people. The bottom line here, he said, is that this is propaganda we used, fed by CIA, was to pave the way for a general acceptance, the imposition of martial law when situations like this get out of hand, which is the way the CIA wants us to view its 51-day siege of the Branch Davidian compound in Waco. Maintaining that the main purpose of the Waco attack by the BATF was to control the subconscious mind and wills of Koresh and his followers, Wilchner told Reno that a variety of techniques were used over the entire 51-day siege following the initial February 28th raid. The news reported some of the PSYOP aspects of the siege, apparently. They made no secret that the FBI was shining high-powered spotlights on the compounds at night and bombarding it with various kinds of sounds like acid rock music, Tibetan chants, Christmas songs, and so forth. It was obviously meant to annoy and deprive the people inside the compound of sleep. The news accounts quoted that the FBI spokesperson as saying that if sounds worked, the inhabitants of Apocalyptic Ranch would become more pliable to the FBI's demands to surrender peacefully and there would be no loss of life. Wilchner told Reno that the truth was very far different. Quote, these incessant loud and obnoxious noises were merely the cover for what was really bombarding the compound and its occupants, 20 gigahertz microwave transmissions designed to be as stressful and destructive to the human physiology, inner ear, psyche, and mental stability as possible. In short, CIA has perfected the use of such high-intensity microwave transmissions on human subjects to such an extent they are absolutely certain that over time, such transmissions are beyond the ability of most human beings to endure, and the sooner or later, they will drive away a normal person totally crazy, or provoke him or her to suicide or murder. One example of CIA use of high-intensity microwave transmission on a human subject occurred during the CIA invasion of Panama when General Manuel Noriega fled the Vatican embassy for sanctuary. What the press reported was the military bombarded the Vatican embassy with very loud acid rock music. What they didn't tell us was that music, again, only the mass to cover what was really being beamed at General Noriega. The same density microwave transmissions are known to be beyond the limits of most human beings to endure, or at least over any extended period of time. And remember, Wilchner wrote, that a Branch Davidian compound, these high-intensity microwave transmissions continued, almost without interruption, day and night, throughout the entire length of the 51-day siege, and that there were more than 20 children in the compound all this time. No wonder you were concerned about the gross mistreatment of these children, Attorney General Reno, but what the Reagan and Bush holdovers in the Justice Department, FBI, and BAT failed to tell you was that it was our own FBI and CIA who were responsible for mistreating these children. Through these high-intensity microwave transmissions, bombarding the compound for 51 days. Apparently, what no one told Wilchner was, the cryptocracy is in control of the public consciousness. There is nothing but holdovers from one administration to another. In fact, it doesn't matter whether a Democrat or a Republican is in the White House. Whoever is there occupies it with the content and consent of the cryptocracy. This goes for appointed as well as Janet Reno included. Wilchner continued. Also included in these bombarding transmissions were neurolinguistic programming and other subliminal messages designed to reach the subconscious minds of Koresh and his six fellow sleepers in order to reassert CIA mind control over them and to make them more pliant and obedient to CIA commands and domination. The reader is advised to obtain Jeannie Laborde's landmark work book on NLP entitled Influencing with Integrity, or any other Anthony Robbins works to gain a balanced view of this new emerging science. Wilchner's letter to Reno maintains that the original plan behind the siege of Koresh's compound, which we assume he got from the informants who were ready to come forward, was to have the Delta Force make a night raid on the compound. The Delta Force is no secret. It is an elite commando-style military unit composed of specifically trained members of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, operating under the command of Joint Chiefs of Staff and CIA. Delta was to apply the elements of surprise and lightning quick speed for which they are especially trained to bring everyone out alive except for David Koresh and his six fellow CIA sleepers. Wilchner continued in his letter to Janet Reno. These seven men were to be killed, no questions asked, period. He reported to the nation, Attorney General Reno, that you met with President Clinton on Sunday, April 18th, and that after outlining the plan you had been given to him and going over it in some detail, he told you was to go ahead if you thought this was the thing to do. You have also reported to the nation that having given the ultimate go-ahead for the plan, you and President Clinton are the ones ultimately responsible for what happened in Waco on Monday, April 19th, 1993. That, however, is simply not true. Attorney General Reno, what happened in Waco is not your fault, nor is it the President Clinton's fault, for the Reagan and Bush holdovers at the Justice Department, FBI, BATF, and CIA, who carefully planned and orchestrated this disaster, never informed you as to what the secret right-wing political agenda was at this time. Therefore, neither you nor President Clinton had any idea what had actually been planned for this operation in Waco, much less any hint of the secret agenda which to be served by the mass murder and cover-up to protect the criminal machinations of CIA. Here we suspect Wilchner was wrong again in his assumption that the occupants of the Oval Office and their appointees are not part of the cryptocracy until the National Security Act is repealed and the cryptocracy weeded out is overthrown. But to continue with Wilchner's letter, in which his sources have informed him on the details of events that, if true, only insiders could have known. On the 18th, The president in Parkland Hospital in Dallas was alerted to be prepared to receive a large number of serious burn victims from Waco the following day. On the morning of the 19th, Delta Force commandos were on alert, ready to carry out the first plan that had been approved. Wilshner said that this was not just an ordinary Delta team, but a special team of CIA-selected professional killers trained to accomplish a mass murder so that it would be covered up to look like a Jonestown type mass suicide. This Delta Force team was composed of 15 men, Wilshner said, headed by Lieutenant Colonel, who was CIA liaison officer. They flew into Texas on their own C-130 belonging to the Triangle. Of the 15 men, there were four main teams, the one which actually made the insertion into the compound and a backup team, which apparently was never used. The team wore black and looked like all the other FBI officers on the ground. The nation watched on CNN that morning as the M1A1 tanks punched holes in the exterior walls of the compound's living quarters. What was not visible was the gas that was pumped into the compound, gas which the press later reported as tear gas. Wilshner continued in his letter to Reno. This tear gas has been designed to be used for crowd control, i.e., it was so virulent and irritating that even on fresh air out of doors situation, it was guaranteed to cause people to flee from its presence instantly, simply in order to be able to breathe. Now, it was being used in a closed-door, indoor living quarters situation where 95 men, women, and children were trapped inside. The logical expectation would have been that all 95 of these persons would have fled out of doors instantly, just to be able to breathe. But strangely, not a single person came out of the compound, even if this noisous substance had been poured into the compound in enormous quantities over a period of several hours. The logical question, therefore, arises, why? Why did not any of these 95 men, women, and children, particularly the women and their children, instantly flee for fresh air into the out-of-doors? The answer given by FBI spokesmen and repeated by the news media was that Koresh and his church members had outfitted themselves with gas masks. Wilshner told Reno the reason that Davidians inside the compound didn't flee was, quote, because the tear gas contained a neurotoxin, nerve gas, a virulent poisonous substance like Koresh, which independently paralyzes, rendered totally helpless and defenseless on all 95 women and children inside the compound, except for those 9 later rescued. For all the others, they could no longer coordinate their muscles and in an effort required them to get up, much less flee to the life-sustaining fresh air outside, only a few feet away. Wilshner inserted a note after this set off. In wider margins, he wrote, "This is extremely serious matter, Attorney General Reno, for it means that here in the U.S. military, FBI and Justice Department, all directed by CIA, use nerve gas on innocent men, women, children, and our civilian population, and the produced murder them in cold blood as set forth in details below. This clearly rises to the level of war crimes on a civilian population during peacetime and unspeakable human rights violations. And it was committed by our intelligence community against innocent men, women, and children, simply to bury the truth concerning CIA criminal use of mind control programming to manufacture Manchurian candidate-type robot assassins whose very existence is an unspeakable outrage in and out of itself." According to Wilcher, after the tear gas combination had time to do its paralyzing work on the men, women, and children in the compound, a 4-man Delta Force team, some of CIA's top professional assassins, made its entry into the compound after they were dropped into the roof by one of the low-flying, heavily armed military helicopters, which hovered overhead most of the day. With TV cameras focused on the tanks, the actual insertion into the building came at approximately 10:25 a.m. Before they entered the compound, this 4-man team of assassins had received shots of atropine, the antidote to the nerve gas, so that they too would not be overcome and paralyzed by it. Wilcher's letter said that the first thing the team did once it was inside the building was to subdue and kill David Koresh by putting a single bullet in the middle of his forehead about an inch above his eyes. The bullet was fired from about 4 inches away. Relevant to the claim in the article in the 18th Washington Post, In 1993, the article quotes forensic pathologist Dr. Cyril Wecht of Pittsburgh, who completed an independent autopsy of the bodies of David Koresh and one of his chief lieutenants, Steve Schneider. Wecht said that the gunshot wound in the middle of the forehead which killed Koresh and the gunshot wound in the back of the head of Schneider were not typical of suicide. Please note that the FBI psychological profile of Koresh showed him not to be a suicidal. Wilsner points out that the FBI, through CIA, had access to all of the relevant information on him. While the WET team did kill many of those, dating back to and including the programming to become one of CIA's Manchurian Candidate-type robot assassins, they must have known, even that early on, that the normal self-destruct program response implanted into the subconscious psyche of most CIA sleepers was not work on Koresh. Consider almost all points made by a teenage girl on the NBC Nightly News Tuesday, May 14, 1993, who had been a member of the Branch Davidian cult in Waco until shortly before the April 17th disaster. She stated in this interview that all of the children in the compound were repeatedly grilled by Koresh on precisely how to commit suicide, either by taking cyanide poison or by gunshot. But she said Koresh always insisted that you must put the gun in your mouth before pulling the trigger. If you put the gun to your temple, there is always the danger that you might survive, but as a vegetable. The New York Times on May 5, 1993 reported that two-thirds of the bodies autopsied had bullet wounds in them which examiners said had been inflicted after the date of the initial BATF raid on February 28th. The same article stated that 17 of the children were killed by means of poisonous injections. Wilcher went on to say, quote, "Although I have no specific information on that point, all of my other information, including the fact that everyone else in the building except those nine had been targeted to be saved, were paralyzed by the nerve gas, thus had been rendered incapable of moving at all, strongly suggests that those children were likewise taken out by CIA and the WET team." Wilchner went on to state that the fires were fueled by White House phosphorus, one of the most fearsome incendiary devices imaginable, and a favorite of WET teams. It ignites instantly, burning immediately with a white-hot intensity which consumes everything beyond all recognition, destroying all possible forensic evidence in its path. Wilchner said, "CIA WET teams have also been known to corner their intended targets into a closed corner and then throw Willy Peter, white phosphorus, in their mindset, said that those victims were instantly immolated right before the team's eyes. The fire which Willy Peter produces is so intense and the combustion so complete that victims, as was the case in Waco, can only be identified by their dental records." Inside the compound prior to setting the fires, they apparently did not murder all of the 86 men, women, and children who ultimately died in the tragedy, meaning that many of these who died were left paralyzed by nerve gas, unable to get up or free themselves from this disaster in progress, and were thus consigned to being consumed alive in the giant conflagration brought on by the white phosphorus. And those consigned to this horrible furry tale, being burned alive, apparently included men, women, and children. Wilsner inserts another note for the emphasis, totaling up the number of men and women and children to 86, murdered in the compound that Monday, April 19, 1993, at the hands of four Delta Force members. And he naively tries to let Attorney General Reno and President Clinton off the hook, saying that other high-ranking officials in our government, including the senior Reagan and Bush administration holdovers in the Justice Department, FBI, BATF, the Pentagon, and CIA, all knew in advance that this Waco operation was designed from the start to be a mass murder in which only those few individuals whom CIA had targeted in advance would be saved. Pointing out the importance of mind control to the cryptocracy, Wilcher wrote, "One of the uses of CIA makes of its mind control sophistication is to implant memory blocks into the subconscious memories of its top professional assassins in order to allow them to live with what they have done and not to be overcome by flashbacks and nightmares of their own handiwork." Author's note: I have been informed that those memory blocks are not holding very well in this instance, and that some of all of the four members of the particular WET team are sickened by what they ordered to do and what they did, in fact, accomplish in Waco on April 19th. To these hardened, seasoned professional assassins, it was all too easy. The people inside the compound, as a result of nerve gas, simply never had a chance. It would appear that some of the contacts Wolfner had were among these Delta Force assassins, and 12 others, 16 in all, who were ready to come forward and testify about what happened inside the compound. Wolfner spoke of a shadow government, which used the CIA to achieve its own ends. He said that it was responsible for the murder of JFK and 175 more key witnesses to his assassinations of Dr. Martin Luther King, a number of witnesses to a murder, Senator Robert F. Kennedy, and witnesses Malcolm X, J. Edgar Hoover, and his close associate Tolson in the midst of the Watergate scandal, Martha Mitchell, Senator John Tower, Senator John Hines, Congressman Ted Weiss, and John Lennon. He also said that the attempt on the life of President Ronald Reagan was engineered by the shadow government, of which the identity of leader would be revealed to Reno by the 16 covert operatives who wished to come forward. Wolfner went on to say that the October surprise caper was treason by which George Bush, Ronald Reagan, and a select group of present and former CIA covert operatives rigged and thus stole the 1980 U.S. presidential election on November 4, 1980. He claimed 50 or so witnesses were murdered over the years, witnesses who could have testified as to the truth of what actually happened in the October surprise and Iran-Contra scandals. He called this shadow government the mother of all corruption, for the tentacles of this giant RICO conspiracy extend all across our nation and reached into all levels and functions of the federal government, he said. This shadow government operates those functions of government which it controls in the same manner that organized crime uses to run its myriad criminal racketeering enterprises. Indeed, that is the whole point here, that this shadow government conducts the business of government not in an open, honest, legitimate, and forthright manner, according to laws, constitution, and democratic principles in the United States, but rather in a secret, clandestine, and utterly illegal manner, as if they were ruining and running a criminal racketeering enterprise. Wilson pointed out to the wholesale theft of billions and billions of dollars from the savings and loan associations and the banks of this country by intelligence community, saying that, quote, the proceeds of these massive thievery largely was to fund illegal black operations, which involved illegal gun running out of this country, illegal drug smuggling out of this country, and illegal money laundering in both directions, all on a massive scale by intelligence community. Other than the testimony of Wolfner's client, Gunter Reschberger, there is evidence that Koresh was the subject of hypnotic programming and used it himself on members of his church. Among other telltale signs of mind control, Koresh's songs and sermons contained obvious phonetic embeds like those used in hypnoprogramming. Phonetic embeds are a linguistic phenomenon which words are enfolded inside other words in such a way that no one could deny that they are there. Few laymen, however, would admit that these mere words can influence behavior. Professionals, however, know that. If the subliminal meanings make sense, they can reinforce and surface meanings and produce powerful behavioral effects. As one scholar quipped, the alphabet creates the significant infinite regress. Much of the research done on phonetic embeds has been done by scholars studying James Joyce's Finnegan's Wake. David Koresh's letter of January 30, 1997, while hardly equal to Joyce's masterwork in which nearly every word is a phonetic embed, was full of linguistic embeds like those used in hypnosis. I have seven eyes and seven horns. My name is the Word of God, and I ride on a white horse. I am here on earth to give you the seventh angel's message. I have ascended from the east with the seal of the living God. My name is Cyrus, and I am here to destroy Babylon. I have come in a way that is contrary to your preconceived ideas. I will reprove you for your world loving. I will scold your daughters for their nakedness and pride that they parade in my father's house. And by my angels, I will strip them naked before all eyes of their foolish pride. The young men will abuse my kindness. They will take my life, but I will arise and take theirs forevermore. Your ministers will lament your foolishness. Your lost flock will tear you to pieces. Prepare to meet thy God. David Koresh. Paul Wilchner tried to meet with Anthony Janet Reno on May 5, 1993, for a confidential conversation. Unable to see the Attorney General, he was instead unseen by Assistant U.S. Attorney Zipperstein. Obviously frustrated by the sluggish bureaucratic response on May 21, 1993, Paul Wilchner sent a 105-page letter to Attorney General Reno. TV correspondent Sarah McClendon describes it as very eloquent. Other than revealing the covert operations, wanted to come forward with the truth about Waco and other secret government operations, it ends with the highest urgent plea on the first page. The lives of key participants, other witnesses, and even myself are now in grave danger as a result of passing this information on to you. If you let this information fall into the hands of the wrong people, some or all of those who know about the truth about Waco and are prepared to come forward and testify could well be murdered. Paul Wilchner's body was found on the toilet. He had bled extensively from the colon. An autopsy was performed by Dr. Kim, who declared his findings no cause of death. The morgue called the Washington, D.C. Medical Examiner offices. The office sent tissue samples and Wilchner's organs to the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Why Walter Reed? Because it is the location of directed energy biomedical research. The body was quickly cremated. Talk on the cybersomatic about the Wilcher had been targeted by a highly amplified infrasound beam. One report from the scene described Wilcher's blood as being expelled from the colon while the body was being removed. This description is consistent with internal organ rupture. Host of Mind Control Forum on Genie Gorilla's journalist Rita Hill informed the world about her friend Paul Wilchner. Attorney Paul Wilchner died where he lived, Washington, D.C. His apartment was in a brick building in Northwest Washington and an agreeable neighborhood in a city known for disagreements. In the early afternoon of June 23, 1993, a person's NBC video crew arrived at 637 3rd Street, his address. White House correspondent Sarah McClendon was on the scene soon after. The body had been removed 2 hours before, however, and no members of the news media would be allowed to enter the Wilcher home on this Wednesday. The Washington, D.C. police had contacted the FBI at about noon. Assistant Special Agent in Charge James DiSerino, several other FBI agents, and CIA agent would survey their location before dusk. By the next day, the forensic evidence in the apartment, his notes, papers, and the files in his personal computer had all been cleaned out. Although more than 9 federal agents investigated the scene crime, the FBI claimed they were not interested in pursuing the matter. News media coverage was non-existent, while the internal ran rife with speculation. One of Wilcher's clients was none other than Gunter Rushberger, a key figure of the Inslaw scandal. Hill continued. Gunter had been a deep black CIA operative and in 1993 was a prisoner in Missouri. Over the previous 3 years, Wilcher had become Rushbacher's lawyer and was increasingly confided by the spymaster. In the immoral chess game of international espionage, Rushbacher became grand champion. He had been viewed by various people as a scoundrel, martyr, patriot, traitor, assassin, and a hero. All of the aforementioned. In his letter to the Attorney General, Wilchner had written, "My client here is Gunter Carl Rushberger, a lifelong covert operative for CIA and the Office of Naval Intelligence, who has operated at the highest levels of both of these super-secret organizations over the past 30 years, 25 respectively. Because of extremely high intelligence, his exceptional physical skills, his extensive training, his fluency in 8 languages, his proficiency as one of CIA's top pilots and marksmen, and the fact that his father was one of the original founders, along with William Casey, Wild Bill Donovan, and others, of the CIA back in 1947. Gunter has always operated at the highest levels of these intelligence organizations and has been entrusted with carrying out some of their most difficult, sensitive, and top-secret covert operations." Hill continued, "The best yardstick for a character as complex as Rushberger may be the measure of this familiar's. Two who are well known are Mikhail Gorbachev and Admiral Robert Inman. The less segments include his wife, Raylene, exposer, Rodney Stitch, and the late Paul Wilshire, all people from different backgrounds with strong principles and a willingness to make great sacrifices for their great principles. Admiral Inman resigned from CIA in 86. This was an unprecedented action for any high-ranking CIA officer, let alone Director of Office of Naval Intelligence. It was an unprecedented as Gorbachev's initiatives, glasnost and perestroika. By the late 1980s, Americans' intelligence community had become divided by scandals as well as Cold War raisins. As CIA operations in the new scenario, Rusbacher found himself in a no-man's land. In 1989, he married Ray Allen, the widow of Navy physicist John Dyer. The handwritten newsletter articles critical of CIA. Gunter was arrested shortly after their marriage and was incarcerated in one of the many increasingly harsh prisons he would occupy for the next 4+ years. On the evening of April 30, 1991, Rusbacher missioned a helicopter flight from Alameda, California to Fort Gordon, California. He said someone drugged his coffee, causing him to miss the flight. After the helicopter exploded, he started telling his story. Journalists and concerned citizens listened for hours on end as the darkest secrets of CIA were revealed in great detail. They had truly been an October surprise deal with the Reagan-Bush people in 1980 to keep 52 Americans hostage in Tehran until Reagan became president. CIA had indeed participated in the looting of the SNLs. Yes, the agency did use directed energy mind control weapons on people and wanted to control, and on and on and on. For speaking up, Rusbacher was tortured while in prison. Talk radio personality Dave Emery relayed one incident. His cellmate began not only throwing up blood, but defecating blood in extremes, Emery said, literally spewing blood out of both ends of his anatomy. If the incident had been a warning, it had not seemed to break Gunter's resolve. Later in Missouri, he endured 3 separate heart attacks, but he kept on talking. Directed energy weapons can cause both heart attacks and internal organ ruptures. The January-February 1989 issue of Bioelectric Magnetics Society newsletter stated that Walter Reed's Department of Microwave Research had acquired the hardware needed to test the biological effects of high-powered pulsed microwaves in 1987. It revealed that but such microwave energy penetrates all organ systems of the body, and this puts every organ system at risk. Under the subheading Cardiovascular Research, the report continued, the team has obtained evidence that a non-lethal effect postulated several years ago does in fact occur and must be considered as potentially serious. The U.S. Army Research Laboratory was slated to make a presentation promoting weapons based on this research. The exhibition was entitled High-Powered Microwave Technology. Hill went on to write, whether or not David Koresh's Branch Davidians were planning to execute a quasi-military operation as national security, spokeswoman would have us believe, the real tragedy at Waco is how these people were set up. Since at least the 50s, Project Artichoke, CIA had available mind-control brainwashing techniques as a way to create agent provocateurs. These people would be hypnotized, perform agency dirty work upon receiving a pre-programmed signal. The intelligence community refers to subjects as sleepers. In the last 2 decades, CIA had increasingly used microwaves transmitting cues directly in the subconscious minds of their sleepers. The FBI admitted discussing the use of such technology on Koresh. This published in July 93 article in the Defense Electronics by Mark Tavascott. Paul Wilchner heard that Koresh and 6 others, Branch Davidians, were sleepers on March 11th. Wilchner's letter shows a high degree of confidence in the information he received about Waco. At least one of Wilchner's contacts says that all 4 members of the Delta Force team have been assassinated, along with many of their family members, Hill said. Loretta Hearn, a listener to one of my radio interviews, sent me a page from Secretary William Worrell's, and he found the name Cyrus in a Hebrew Koresh. He embedded a cult and moved away to the colony that formed several hundred people in Fort Myers, Florida. Mrs. Hearn wrote, I believe David Koresh was a mind control experiment by one of the government's intelligence divisions, and Koresh's maniacal program had used a previously little known religious sect as a model to 4 scenario. Nobody could be found for an autopsy as it would reveal an implant. another interesting coincidence that David Koresh's name, his son, is Cyrus.